heard anything yet. So. I want to start by thanking. Can everybody hear me in the back? Yeah. I don't need a mic. Louder.
Louder.
So I want to thank the Denali Oncology Nursing Society for inviting me to speak. I spoke last year on PARP inhibitors and VEGF inhibitors, and that seemed to go pretty well. My name is Rob Nibby. I got my PhD at Case Western University in 2009 in the lab of Mark Chance. This is a lab in dealing with proteomics and bioinformatics methods. I'm still currently a postdoc in his lab half-time. The other half of my time is split with NeoProteomics. We're a small startup company in Northeast Ohio. We're involved in doing research and biomarker discovery and various computational approaches to finding companion diagnostics in cancer as well. So that's kind of how I split my time. Unlike Laura's presentation, I'm not going to talk to you about clinical indications of bone metastasis or treatments or show you any pictures of patients. I'm going to talk to you, sort of back up a little bit and talk about the research involved, or not actually the research involved, but some of the research findings at the molecular level that cause bone mets and sustain bone mets. And Terry asked that I talk, kind of focus on RANK ligand. Some of you may be familiar with RANK. If you're not, hopefully some of the slides I show you will give you more information about that, and some of the therapeutic approaches. Throughout the talk, there's a number of figures that are going to appear on my slides. Those have been taken primarily from journal articles. I've properly attributed those figures, and in square brackets next to each attribution is a number. That is the PubMed ID referencing the paper. So if you find something very intriguing and you want to follow up on it, just take that little number, go to pubmed.org, put it in the search, and the paper will come up. If you have access to it through your institution, it will show up. The other thing is, when I first talked to Terry, I nominally prepared for a talk of about 25 to 30 minutes. So I'm going to talk slow, because it looks like I have an hour. But hopefully there will be a lot of Q&A afterwards, so we'll have enough time for that. Okay? So, by way of an outline, I'm going to talk to you a little bit about, introduce bone metastasis and the steps involved. I'll then characterize the two major lesion types in bone mets, osteolytic versus osteoblastic. Talk a little bit more about the molecular regulation in bone metastases. Some of the prominent cancer types where bone mets are most often found. The importance of the microenvironment of metastasis, which is probably an underappreciated area, at least maybe at the clinical level, but at the molecular level, it's actually quite interesting. Then we'll talk a little bit about the pharmacology of some of the targets involved in treating bone mets, and then I'll give you hopefully an interesting summary. So bone mets, as most of you know, this definition captures what you probably understand it to be. It just means that we have a tumor which has grown in the primary site. The cells are able to escape, penetrate the endothelial barrier, and then they're off into the bloodstream or the lymphatics to set up housing in a distant organ. This is a figure that comes from a paper we published, oh, I guess 2 years ago now, in Biomarkers in Medicine. I don't show you, this is an example of a colon cancer staging of a tumor. I don't show you this because colon cancers are associated with bone mets. They're not. Usually metastasis in the colon goes to the liver. But the reason I'm showing you this is because it isn't so much that metastasis occurs when tumors get very large, as you can see here in a metastatic stage 4 tumor in the colon. But their ability, even when the lymphatics and the blood vessels invade the tumor, what has to happen is the cells in the tumor have to be able to detach. So they're normally, in a normal state, adhered, or in a less severe state, I should say, they adhere to the extracellular matrix. And they do that by certain cell receptor molecules called adhesion molecules or integrins. by the time that tumors become this dysregulated, in terms of their molecular mechanisms, they become this severe, there are a lot of genetic mutations. These cells are messed up. Okay? So even the integrins and the adhesion molecules at the surface no longer function properly. And when they stop functioning properly, the cells can actually release from the matrix. And it's that release from the matrix which is really the first sign of bone metastasis. So in multi-stage solid tumors, this is pretty common, even in breast tumors and renal cell carcinoma tumors like Laura talked about. Mortality, about 70% of deaths from cancer are from those three types of cancers, and about 350,000 deaths a year occur from bone mets. The symptoms of severe bone pain, etiology is somewhat unknown, that's an active area of research actually. It can have fractures, hypercalcemia, and it can lead to other complications as well, including nerve compression and severe immobility in patients with a heavy tumor burden. Okay, so here are the basic steps to bone metastasis. And I thought it was a very nice figure that captured what's going on at the molecular and cellular level. So if you consider that you have a primary tumor which starts in a bed surrounded by a sea of normal cells, these are the tumor cells, as these cells begin to divide and proliferate, they start to secrete factors into the environment that induces and stimulates the activity of increased blood vessel formation. Okay? As those blood vessels start to intercalate the tumor bed and more factors are secreted, ultimately the tumors are able to penetrate the endothelial. That's an important event because if the tumors aren't able to get into the bloodstream through that endothelial barrier, you won't have a metastasis. Once they get inside the blood vessel, they travel along with lymphocytes and platelets, and these tumor cells tend to aggregate and form what is basically an embolism in the bloodstream. Okay? They travel and tumble through the bloodstream until they reach the capillary beds of the bone, and expressed at the capillary beds of the bone are certain scaffold proteins which form attachment surfaces for these emboli. Okay? And these cells are actually captured at that point. And we're going to talk a little bit about why it happens at bone and why it doesn't happen in other tissues for some of these cancers I mentioned earlier. Once they're attached to that scaffold, they're basically stuck. Now they're still inside the endothelial barrier. So the next step is for them to secrete certain molecules, which we'll talk about, that allow them to get out or extravasate the endothelial barrier. They respond to more factors which are in the tumor microenvironment at bone. They set up a proliferation axis and they're able to form a lesion. So these are basically the steps all the way from the primary tumor all the way to bone that are involved in bone mass. So I said I wasn't going to talk too much about the indications, but a very big problem in bone mets is hypercalcemia. What I'm showing here on the diagram is the regulation of calcium in a normal human being. Okay? You have exogenous calcium coming in from your diet, and these are the exchange rates between the extracellular fluid, bone, and your renal tissue. Okay? But in hypercalcemia, with patients with a very heavy tumor burden, one of the contributing factors to help hypercalcemia is bone destruction. We're going to talk about the molecular mechanism of how that occurs. But when bone destruction occurs, you get a lot of the matrix being dissolved and a lot of the matrix being digested. A product of that digestion by osteoclasts is increased calcium because bone is very rich in calcium. So this number goes up dramatically. Consequently, this number, the uptake by the renal tubulars, goes up dramatically as well. Now, patients on bisphosphonates actually see quite a bit of improvement at this area. But it is this area that is unknown whether there's any effect at all from bisphosphonates or if it's actually transient in patients. Okay? So this is actually an underappreciated aspect of hypercalcemia in patients, what's going on. So it's this whole dysregulation of the homeostatic mechanism of calcium uptake and return that is the major cause of hypercalcemia. Okay, so on to the kind of the two lesion types. So the two main players in bone metastasis are osteoclasts and osteoblasts. In normal bone, those two mechanisms are tightly regulated. So osteoclasts, shown here on this histologic slide to bone tissue, are actually responsible for bone resorption. That is, they break down bone and lead to conditions such as osteoporosis. Okay. Osteoblasts, by contrast, actually lay down bone. They form new matrix. And in patients with a heavy tumor burden and osteolytic lesions, here shown with renal carcinoma cells invading the bone, they actually hyperactivate the osteoclast and break down bone. And this leads to the condition of osteoporosis. In osteoblastic lesions, by contrast, overactive osteoblasts actually lay down more matrix, and this leads to increased bone density. And this is a condition known as osteopetrosis. So here is basically, at the molecular level, what's going on or what's known to be going on. Okay. So imagine you have a tumor cell sitting up here. This has invaded the bone matrix, as I showed before. It's gone through the full cycle. It's now at the site of bone. This tumor cell is able to secrete a factor called PTHRP. PTHRP stands for parathyroid-related peptide. Okay, and I'm going to describe this in a little more detail later. But this is highly overexpressed in particularly breast cancer cells. Okay, what this related peptide does, along with the secretion of a number of IL genes, it upregulates the expression of something on the stromal cells and osteoblast cells in the microenvironment called RANK L. RANK L stands for receptor activator nuclear factor NFKB ligand. Okay, and I'm going to tell you just a little bit about what this is. So RANK is actually expressed on the cellular surface of these osteoblasts and stromal cells normally. But when activated by this peptide, which is secreted by the tumor cells in the microenvironment, it actually upregulates or increases the expression of RANK on the cell surface. So you have many more of these molecules on the cell surface. RANK L then is a ligand for the cognate receptor RANK, which is expressed on the cell surface of osteoclast progenitor cells. So osteoclasts, when they're first made, are actually quite immature, and they don't have full activity component on board. But when RANK L binds RANK, this actually activates two intracellular pathways. One is called the JUNK pathway, and one is called IKK. I'm not going to go into the details of that. Suffice it to say that this is a signal transduction pathway once this binding event occurs, that leads to the upregulation and activity of two transcription factors. Okay? Transcription factors are proteins that sit on the DNA in the nucleus, and when there's more of them or they're hyperactive, they actually lead to the expression of all their cognate genes much more than is normally required. Okay? That's what a transcription factor is. Once those transcription factors are more active, they upregulate a gene expression program in the nucleus, and all the products of those genes, which are now upregulated, lead to differentiation, fusion, and increased survival of the osteoclast. So you take an immature osteoclast, you make it mature more quickly, you increase its activity, and there are a number of genes involved in this upregulation that actually add to the survival of those osteoclasts as well. Okay, more active osteoclast means more active bone resorption, and you increase the osteolytic lesion. I'm just going to point this little guy out. OPG stands for osteoprogeriton. This is actually a decoy receptor at the bone microenvironment for RANK L. I'll talk a little bit more about that near the end of the talk about it as a drug target. But OPG is actually downregulated, or its activity is reduced by the secretion of this PHD peptide. Okay? So you have two things going on. The take-home message from this is that we're increasing all of the factors that lead to a gene program which favors osteoclast activity, and we're suppressing the OPG, which would be a decoy receptor for RANK L. If RANK L binds OPG, then it can't bind RANK. It can only do one at a time, right? So if I have more of these guys around, then I have fewer of these binding events, and you would now regulate osteolysis. But in this case, this peptide is actually doing two things to increase osteolysis. Okay? How about osteoblastic metastasis? Well, these are the molecular mechanisms involved in that. There's always a yin and yang between osteoblastic lesions and osteolytic lesions. So in osteoblastic lesions, typically what happens is osteoclasts are chewing up bone and chewing up bone, and once the bone gets thin enough, if you will, or there are certain signals in the environment which indicate that osteoblasts should now start laying down more bone, a number of factors get secreted by osteoclasts which cause their own apoptosis. That is, the cells die. Okay. Once the cells die, osteoblasts can now come into effect, and they increase their proliferation. And the way they do that is by bone morphogenic proteins. So when the osteoclasts die, the bone morphogenic proteins come up. Osteoblasts now can home to that signal. There's a number of other factors that are secreted once osteoclasts start to die. TGF-beta, some of you have heard about that. This is an inflammatory protein. Other FGFs, this is a fibrin and growth factors, and PDGF, a platelet-derived growth factor. So all of these factors favor osteoblasts over osteoclasts. Okay. Another thing that can happen, particularly in prostate cancer and bone mets, is the tumor cells can secrete something called urokinase. Urokinase is a protease. And a protease is a protein which can actually clip or cleave other proteins. And if you cleave some of those proteins, they become more active. Okay, so here you're shown that urokinase can actually cleave integrin growth factor binding proteins. These lead to increased osteoblast activity and bone formation. Latent TGF-beta, if it's cleaved in a certain way, has increased activity towards bone formation. And this protease can actually reduce the activity of PTHRP, which I told you about before, increase osteoclast activity. Right? So osteoclast activity down, bone formation is up.
When the new cells are formed, are they already warped into the mets?
Which new cells?
Well, you said that the osteoclasts, when the cells die, they start to reform new cells that are warped. Or are they already full of cancer at that time?
Yeah, so the osteoclasts are, I would say, constantly dying and being reborn.
Right.
But their activity, if this is what you're referring to, their activity, ultimately, after enough bone is laid down, there are signals in the bone environment that will trigger the osteoclasts now to become more active and to eat away at that bone or to destroy it. Okay, so that's what's going on in a normal patient. But somebody who has mets, that whole regulatory yin-yang gets very messed up. And depending on the factors secreted by the tumor cells in the environment, we'll talk a little bit about how different tumor cells secrete different factors. And so you get either an osteoblastic lesion or an osteolytic lesion, depending on that interval. But the cells themselves are constantly dying. Okay. So we've talked about kind of characterizing the two kinds of lesions. These are basically the lytic and blastic tendencies of most of the human cancers that typically you see bone mets associated with. In breast, most lesions are dominantly osteolytic. Although, again, because of the yin-yang principle, about 15 to 20% are osteoblastic. That's kind of interesting that an assay for bone formation, excessive bone formation, is actually an indication of an osteolytic lesion. Because osteolytic lesions are destroying bone, and if the osteoblasts are trying to catch up and reform bone, this can be actually an indication that you have an osteolytic lesion, not an osteoblastic lesion. Lung metastases are frequently osteolytic, although those of you who have been paying attention closely, a couple slides ago I showed that lung cancer cells were actually increasing the density of the trabecula, or the bone scaffolds. So it's not always the case that they're osteolytic, but they are most often osteolytic. Prostates are mostly always osteoblastic, although this is an active area of research because the markers of bone resorption, the number of the osteoclasts does not go up, but the markers do. So it's kind of an active area of research on which lesions are dominant in prostate, but as of now, it seems that most of them are osteoplastic. Myeloma is not actually a metastasis per se, but it shows a lot of, for those of you who work in myeloma, it has a lot of the same phenotypes at the molecular level that these three cancers do. And these lesions are almost exclusively osteoplastic. Okay, I talked a little bit before about this peptide, and this is kind of interesting. I'm going to make bioinformaticians or structural biologists out of all of you. Okay? So parathyroid hormone, or PTH, this is a small peptide which is coded by a separate gene than PTHRP. Okay? And it's secreted by the parathyroid gland in response to low calcium. And in the bone, it tends to stimulate osteoblasts, which in turn activate osteoclasts, right? If I stimulate an osteoblast, it makes more RANK L ligand on its cell surface, that binds to the osteoclast RANK molecule, that makes them more active, and so on and so forth. But the related peptide, PTHRP, this is encoded by a completely separate gene. Okay? And it's 140 amino acid polypeptide. And it's highly expressed in breast tumor cells. So once the breast tumor cells get to the microenvironment, they're secreting this stuff like wild. Why is that important? Well, because the cognate receptor of PTH is actually PTH1R. This is an isoform of a receptor expressed on stromal cells. When that receptor is tickled by its ligand, it increases the expression of RANKL, and I've already told you what increased RANKL expression does. Okay? And this is kind of interesting. The structural biology of this is as follows. All these ribbon diagrams you can largely ignore. This is what structural biologists do. They crystallize these peptides. They look at their 3D conformation because most of you probably all know that in order for a protein to be active, it needs to fold up properly, right? It's not just a string of pearls of amino acids. It has to fold up in water properly. Unless it folds properly, it's not active. So it turns out that when you fold up PTH and PTHRP, they actually fold very similarly, which is not surprising because they both activate this receptor. But if you look down here in G, the reason for that is this. This is the amino acid sequence of PTH, at least out to about 30 residues. And this is PTHRP. The first eight residues of the first 13 residues are identical amino acids. Okay. And the consequence of that is that it's in the binding region for this receptor. Okay. So when those 13 residues fold up at PTH or PTHRP, they both have effectively the identical conformation. Okay. So they can both bind that receptor and tickle RANKL and you lead to an osteoblast lesion. So this stuff is just pouring out of tumor cells, breast cancer tumor cells in the microenvironment and increasing osteoblast. Okay, so this is a very important target in bone mass, particularly in breast cancer. In prostate cancer, which I told you is mostly osteoblastic, there's a number of things going on. So prostate-specific antigen, most of you have heard of that, it's a marker for prostate cancer. This is actually a series of proteins, right? It cuts bonds and proteins, like I told you before. And when it gets in the bone microenvironment, it has three possible roles in metastatic prostate cancer. So it increases RANKL expression. I've already talked to you about that. It decreases OPG. That was that decoy receptor for RANKL. Okay. And so that's going to cause bone resorption. But that's really osteolytic. But the two osteoblastic aspects of PSA is that it increases the expression of a little protein called RUNX2. RUNX2 is another one of these transcription factors, and it's essential for osteoblast differentiation. So if you're going to mature an osteoblast, you have to activate RUNX2 as the take-home message. Okay. And in prostate cancer, RUNX2 expression goes way up. The consequence is that you get increased osteoblasts, and their activity goes up, and you get bone formation. RUNX2 is also expressed in the cancer cells which arrive at the bone. Okay. So once you activate RUNX2 in the cancer cells, it actually has the double dip effect of increasing tumor growth, cellular division, and proliferation. So it's kind of a double dip.
Okay.
So, a little bit of history about the bone microfiber. This is Stephen Paget. He is an English surgeon who lived at the end of the 19th century into the 20th century. And he is the son of Sir James Paget, the famous pathologist who is eponymous with Paget's disease, which is a chronic condition of misshapen bones. He's kind of an interesting character. He did a lot of research into bone metastasis while he was alive, and one of his key hypotheses was that tumor cells with metastasis activity, he called the tumor cells the seed, had a special avidity for the bone microenvironment, or what he called the soil. This was based on some research that he had done over about the last 25 years of his life. Now, shortly after his death, there was another guy that came along named James Ewing, and James Ewing said, no, it's not really the seed soil hypothesis. What's actually going on is that there are mechanical factors in the bone that are expressed near the endothelium, and this particular structure allows these cells to set up residency in the bone because they trap the cells. Remember on one of the first slides I showed you that those scaffolds are able to trap the tumor cells? That's basically what he was saying accounted for all of the reason that we have bone mets, because of these particular scaffolds are expressed at the bone and not in other soft tissues. Well, there was a problem with that hypothesis, because brain and bone are only served by a relatively small fraction of the circulatory system. Right? So why don't we have mets at the spleen, for instance? That's highly vascular area. It's a solid tissue, and we should be seeing mets there, because all of these tumor cells that are floating around in the blood visit the spleen much more often than just visit the bone or the brain. So it didn't really explain any of that. But for a long time, it was thought that Ewing was probably right. Well, about in 1977, there were some experiments done at mice. And people wanted to find out what was actually going on, why the bone was the preferred site of metastasis for some common cancer. And what they found was that a number of things. That tissue-specific mechanical factors, like the scaffold I told you about, are important. But what's just as important are the factors secreted to the microenvironment. So it depends on what cells are actually arriving at the bone and what they're secreting and how those factors interact with what the bone is secreting that determines whether or not those cells hang out and form a lesion. Okay. And the second thing is that the molecular characteristics of the primary neoplastic cells are important, which is just a restatement. So, a little while later, Paget's hypothesis was proven true. And this was done in even more elaborate mice models. And it led to what is now understood to be the vicious cycle of osteolytic mets. Okay? So it's this whole process between the tumor cells and the bone microenvironment that are important in the lesion setting up shot. Okay, and it goes something like this. If I look at a tumor cell here, we've already talked about PTHRP, that this is highly secreted by these tumor cells in the microenvironment. This activates osteoblasts, which express the Rankl ligand. This turns osteoclast precursors when it binds that Rank molecule on the osteoclast, makes them mature, and you set up the perfect situation for increased osteolysis. Okay? As that starts to occur, more TGF-beta is released into the environment. You get a small molecule called IGF-1 released into the environment, and you increase calcium uptake. What's the effect of this happening? Well, TGF-beta is able to bind receptors that sit on the cell of the tumor. Okay, this activates a couple of tumor suppressor or tumor activation pathway and a MAP kinase pathway. The end result of that is it produces even more PTHRP. Okay, more PTHRP just drives this process. IGF-1, coming from osteolysis, actually increases, gives the tumor cells a growth advantage. Okay, so that's a double whammy. And there are, calcium uptake is increased through the through proteins which bind calcium at the cell surface. The pathways which actually activate that are unknown, but it's known to also increase PTHRP secretion. So this is what's called the vicious cycle. You basically increase rank L and you reduce OPG, that decoy receptor, and this is the problem that patients have at the moment. Okay, so I'm almost done. Very briefly, some pharmacology. You're all ready to go into a drug company now and lead their drug effort because you know all of the targets involved. Okay? So bisphosphonates, like clodronate and itadronate, these actually are active against several small molecules in the osteoclasts. There's also a small molecule and an activator called WNT. I didn't tell you too much about that, but evidently bisphosphonates have activity against WNT. And WNT is another one of these sort of canonical pathways, these signaling pathways, which gives tumor cells an increased advantage for survival and proliferation. There are rank L monoclonal antibodies now. The big one is XGEVA from Amgen. Obviously, if this is an antibody which can actually bind to rank L, and when rank L has an antibody stuck to it, it can't bind its cognate receptor, which is rank, and so you downregulate osteoclast activity. There are PTH and PTHRP neutralizing antibodies. Remember, if we can neutralize the activity of that molecule, we can greatly reduce osteolysis, at least that's the theory. The best I was able to find in the literature is that there are certain of these antibodies, at least as of 2004, in phase 3 trials. OPG stimulation would obviously be a way to go, right? This is that decoy receptor. If I can make more copies of OPG or increase its activity, then it will bind more of the rank ligand. That rank ligand, consequently, won't be available to bind rank. And you decrease the incidence of a lesion that way. What are some stimulation agents for OPG? Raloxifene is one, 17-beta estradiol, and there are also a couple of other small molecules in early phase trials which are looking at stimulating OPG or even creating a mimetic for OPG. That is something that would fold up and structurally look like OPG in cells too. There are urokinase inhibitors. There's one by a company in Germany called Wilex, which evidently is in phase 2 approval right now. If I can reduce the activity of those proteases that I showed you earlier in the microenvironment, they would be able to cleave certain protein molecules, and those would not add to the osteolytic regulation. Cathepsin K is actually a cysteine protease. It sits right up here. This is actually a new target by Merck, and I think they're going to go into phase 3 trial in 2013. Cathepsin K is another protease that's responsible for cleaving some of these proteins in the microenvironment that lead to osteolysis as well. So those are some of the relevant targets. So, it's rare that I can find a single picture, or I don't want to bore you with a summary slide, so I found a very nice movie which sort of captures everything we've been talking about today. And if the wireless internet is working, I might actually be able to share it with you. But it really covers everything we've been talking about today. Osteoclast regulation, osteoblast regulation, the importance of certain factors in the tumor microenvironment, and it looks like it's probably going to.
Destruction due to bone metastases or multiple myeloma and bone loss due to hormone ablative therapies can lead to serious skeletal complications. Research has shown that RANK ligand is an essential mediator of the underlying biological mechanism of cancer-related bone diseases across tumor types. Bone is a dynamic tissue which undergoes constant remodeling through the coordinated activity of specialized cells called osteoclasts and osteoblasts. Osteoclasts are specialized cells that resorb bone. while osteoblasts are cells that form new bone. Osteoblasts express RANK ligand, which binds to RANK, a receptor on osteoclasts and osteoclast precursors. This binding promotes differentiation, activation, and survival of osteoclasts. Mature osteoclasts attach to bone and secrete enzymes and acids to form a resorption pit. Osteoblasts migrate into the resorption pit and produce new bone matrix, which mineralizes. In healthy adult bone, the body regulates RANK ligand activity to balance bone formation and bone resorption. In many cancers, the skeleton is the most common site of metastases. Studies suggest up to 75% of patients with advanced breast cancer can develop bone metastases. Similar numbers are seen in prostate cancer. In patients with bone metastases, RANK ligand is an essential mediator of the vicious cycle of bone destruction and tumor growth. Tumor cells that have invaded bone secrete cytokines and growth factors that stimulate osteoblasts to overexpress RANK ligand. As a result, increased RANK ligand signaling drives excessive osteoclast activity and bone resorption. In turn, increased bone resorption releases growth factors from the bone matrix, which may further stimulate tumor growth, thus perpetuating the cycle. Bone disease will develop in 95 to 100% of patients with multiple myeloma. Multiple myeloma cells in bone marrow increase expression of RANK ligand and other factors that increase bone resorption. Increased bone resorption releases cytokines and growth factors from the bone matrix that may further stimulate the growth of myeloma cells and contribute to a vicious cycle of bone destruction. In addition to increased RANK ligand-mediated osteoclast activity, concomitant inhibition of bone-forming osteoblasts further exacerbates bone destruction. Breast cancer lesions often appear osteolytic. While prostate cancer lesions are often blastic or mixed, there is significant osteolytic activity that in some patients is comparable with or higher than that seen in breast cancer and multiple myeloma. This vicious cycle of RANK ligand-mediated bone destruction and tumor growth can lead to devastating pathologic fractures and other skeletal-related events, including palliative radiation to bone, surgery to bone, and spinal cord compression. Patients with breast cancer or prostate cancer receiving hormone ablative therapy are at significantly increased risk of developing bone loss and subsequent fracture. In patients treated with hormone ablative therapy, reduction of sex hormone levels leads to an increase in RANK ligand expression. This drives excessive osteoclast activity, causing systemic bone loss, which can lead to devastating fractures. RANK ligand is a key signal across a continuum of cancer-related bone diseases. In patients with bone metastases and multiple myeloma, RANK ligand drives excessive osteoclast activity, contributing to a vicious cycle of bone destruction and tumor growth that can lead to devastating fractures and other skeletal-related events.
So with that, I'll thank you for your attention and take questions if you have any. Yes?
Well, given the propensity for bone metastases, certain types of cancers, breast and prostate, what, if anything, is being done to prevent mets to bone?
Probably a question I'm unprepared to answer. I don't know if there's any... Well, early detection, right? So if you have early detection of a cancer, presumably you can attack the cancer in its primary site before it goes metastatic. So that would be one obvious answer. I don't know of any relevant pharmacological treatments that would prevent metastasis other than stopping the maturity of the cancer. Before those cells are able to detach from the ECM and the matrix that they're attached to. So you want to get those cells before they're so genetically messed up that those adhesion molecules no longer function properly. Answer the question.
There was a study, there's an ongoing study right now on trying to study breast cancer patients giving their adjuvant before they get preventing metastasis.
And that's I was going to ask you that question because that SWOG study, which is looking at using Zometa to prevent not only bone mets, but actually really to prevent mets of other organs, which goes to that other guy historically.
Stephen Patch.
The other theory.
Yeah. Oh, Ewing's. Ewing's theory.
So I wonder if you know anything about that, because we're starting to use Zometa in people just in the adjuvant setting.
Okay.
I'm a little uncomfortable with that. We do it, but because it's really not. The early studies seem to say maybe there's a SWOG study that's using three different bisphosphonates to see if you can prevent other metastatic disease based on European studies in the 90s.
I think the thing that complicates it too is, especially in population with vitamin D deficiency, and maybe also a higher incidence of osteopenia and osteoporosis, normal latency, that also complicates your situation in your study, the SWOG study itself, because some of those people are osteopenic to begin with, and so they take maybe an oral bisphosphonate or an IV bisphosphonate, and then subsequently they develop breast cancer. And so complicating the situation, complicating your study down there, is the fact that you do have a population, especially in Alaska, or states that you have a higher incidence of osteopenia and osteoporosis in a cancer patient.
But these are people who have breast cancer, non-metastatic, or get adjuvant bisphosphonate to try to prevent mets to other organs.
Right. That's what they're studying in for SWOG. Right. Zometa, or RECLAST, which is the drug, is approved for osteopenia and osteoporosis.
Right.
If you have a breast cancer patient who meets criteria with osteopenia or osteoporosis, technically...
Yeah, but we're using it even just to try to prevent. Yeah, go ahead.
Right, but it's kind of like half dozen of one or the other. I mean, really, it's hard to differentiate.
I'm just concerned that we're starting to use these bisphosphonates to prevent breast cancer when we don't even know what the clinical trials are really showing. But, and then the question I was thinking of is what's the mechanism or the proposed mechanism that, just getting off your topic really, about how these bisphosphonates might prevent metastatic disease to other organs,
Yeah, I'm unprepared to answer that question at that sort of clinical level. I don't know. Most of the talk, my preparation resolved around, sort of what's happening molecularly.
And I missed on it. So the bisphosphonates, and what's the mechanism that they're, what is it, do they inhibit rank ligand formation?
So bisphosphonates are interesting. I didn't actually cover this. Bisphosphonate is a
powder.
This bisphosphonate, the actual chemical biology, the way they work, as I understand it, there are nitrogenous and non-nitrogenous bisphosphonates. But bisphosphonate is basically a mimetic for something called pyrophosphate. So pyrophosphate sits in your cells, and it is required to make ATP. ATP is the energy currency for the cell. So the way bisphosphonates work is they intercalate into the cells. They mimic pyrophosphate, they make a non-functional form of ATP, the cells don't have the energy, and they die. Now there's nitrogenous and non-nitrogenous bisphosphonates. I forget which one does which. I think what I just described to you is a non-nitrogenous one. There's another mechanism of action for bisphosphonates, but suffice it to say that they down-regulate or reduce the activity of osteoclasts eventually, because that molecule actually gets inside the cell and they work on some. One I'm sure of that I just described to you, the other I'm not, I'm not recalling off yet. Any other questions? Okay, well thank you.
Thanks.